This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are delighted that Andrew Solomon is with us. He's written quite an amazing book called The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. But Andrew, you're a reporter. And what Bill was asking about the cultural context that then affects how one manifests, I guess you'd say, depression, all of this is complicated. It's complicated from the one person who can't get out of the bed to the morning to the whole world that is trying to deal with times of great change, isn't it?
Yes. In answer to what I think Bill was asking, I would say that some people have a lot of emotional vocabulary available and can very readily and clearly express what they're feeling. A lot of people, particularly people who have got less analytic education, don't engage in the kind of self-reflection that leads to statements like, I'm depressed, or, well, my level of happiness isn't the same as you. Instead, they don't have words for their emotions. They just feel a certain amount of pain or feel a certain amount of pleasure, and they can't articulate those things so clearly and specifically. So the way that we talk about depression is, I think, specific to an American working and middle class environment. The experience of depression itself extends across classes and across cultures.
You have a section.
That was what you were asking, wasn't it?
He nailed it. That's why he's the reporter and I'm not. A section on poverty, which I think goes to that, because poverty tends to be associated with those people who don't have the vocabulary and are deprived of that vocabulary. They also have legitimate reasons for being non-clinically depressed. But it appears that there are enough feedback systems in this that if you have a reason to get depressed, you might get depressed, and if you don't have a reason to not to get undepressed, that you may continue in that downward spiral.
Well, I would go back.
You put it more elegantly than
that. One can follow it a
you
little more.
You put it beautifully. I would go back to the idea that people have different degrees of vulnerability to depression, and depending on how vulnerable you are, you'll develop depression under certain circumstances of stress and difficulty. There was a popular idea out there that only middle-class people had time to be depressed and that the poor just couldn't get depressed. And I thought, that's ridiculous. We understand where depression comes from, and it's triggered by trauma, and the level of trauma is actually going to be higher among the very poor than it is among the working and middle classes. And so I was very startled by all of these people saying, well, depression isn't really a problem among the poor. And what I came to see is that if you have an essentially fairly good life and you feel miserable all the time, then you think, well, there must be something wrong with me. Maybe I have depression. If you have a life which is at the very bottom of the social scale and you feel miserable all the time, it doesn't occur to you that the way you feel is disjunctive with what you're actually living and what you're experiencing. But often, it's not that you have all of this bleak emotion because your life is so painful and so difficult and so bad, but rather that your life is so painful and difficult and bad because you are depressed. If you don't have the wherewithal to tie your own shoes, then it's very difficult to improve your situation and your lot in life. And so lots of people who have depression end up at the very bottom of the social ladder, experiencing all of these terrible things. And while we attempt to solve the social issues that are out there, we neglect to understand that many of these people would make changes in their own lives if they had the wherewithal to do it. And what I found when I looked at treatment programs for depression among the indigent, of which there are very, very, very few on a very, very limited scale, is that frequently you do random screenings in indigent populations. You pick up people with severe depression. Those people don't know they have depression. They're somewhat alienated by the word and the idea. They have to be really seduced or browbeaten into treatment. But then after they receive treatment for their depression, they bring about extraordinary transformations in their own lives. And I've argued that it makes not only humanitarian sense to provide treatment to these people, which it certainly does because they're suffering, it also makes economic sense because they go from being welfare recipients to being part of the workforce. Their children go from being juvenile delinquents to being more focused on school. All kinds of social changes take place when we provide this kind of treatment. But it has to come out of aggressive outreach because these people will not self-identify as depressed and go see a doctor and say, I need antidepressants.
And the changes are so big that you couldn't sell an article about how big these changes are because your editors wouldn't believe you.
Yes. It looks silly. It looked like, fantasy land.
Yes. I had written an article for a major news magazine, and my editor said the idea that these people are sort of drug addicts living in the streets, homeless, miserable people, and then suddenly, you know, the next thing you know, they're virtually hedge fund managers. She said, I mean, you can't have an article that sort of says all of that. She said, I've never heard anything like it. And I said, the fact that you've never heard anything like it is what makes it news. This is a news magazine. That's why it belongs in these pages. But I think people are very, very uneducated about this and very unaware of what could be done. And, you know, the spirit of welfare reform has so much been that people have to work and people have to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. And a lot of these people don't have any bootstraps. And it's not that difficult to give them bootstraps. And if you do, they're quite happy.
In some ways, the tangled causality, which is part of what you're talking about with respect to the poor, in some ways is sort of easier to see in the same challenges with people who are substance abusers. And the question is, are they substance abusers because they're depressed, or are they depressed because they're substance abusers? And the answer apparently is probably.
The answer, I think, in general is both. And the sadism in the American clinical system for substance abusers and depressed substance abusers is that so much of the time declaration is made that you have to solve one problem before you solve the other. Most often, well, you have to get this person off of substances before you start dealing with their emotional state. And you have to get this person off substances before you can see what their emotional state is. It seems to me that if someone is terribly depressed and finds some alleviation for depression in the abuse of substances, that part of the way to wean that person from substances is to treat the depression so that that neediness becomes somewhat ameliorated.
Why do you say sadism?
Because I think that people are losing the substances in which they found some comfort, inappropriate comfort perhaps, but comfort, and are being left desperately, desperately depressed with nothing to soften or mute emotions that they're unable to handle.
But when you say sadism, that suggests there's an intentionality on the part of the people who are engaging in this. And I'm not talking about the patients, I'm talking about the medical establishment.
Oh, I think that there's a great deal of puritanism about substance abuse and very little sympathy for the fact that people have often become substance abusers for reasons of their own.
You recounted a story that does not blessedly reflect my experience precisely of having ripped your arm out of its socket.
Shoulder dislocated. Mm. Horrible experience.
And I can vouch for how painful it is. And getting to a hospital, which was an appropriate thing to do, in a major metropolitan area, and, you know, presumably a very good hospital. And this is after years of having to deal with your depression. And telling the doctors, going through your history, and the doctor is basically telling you, I'm the doctor, I'm here to help you, and shut up, I know best, and letting you sit for, 8 hours with what is one of the most painful things that most people can endure.
And that pain triggers major onsets of depression.
Well, it screws up the chemistry, and you spend a lot of time keeping the chemistry more or less balanced.
The thing is that if you know you're vulnerable to depression and you've had it before, you have to act in all areas of life with a certain degree of caution. There's a fundamental innocence that you lose when your mind turns against you that way for the first time. And forever afterwards, you have to think to yourself about everything. If I do this and it's very stressful, is that going to trigger a depression again? If I do this and it's very painful, will that trigger a depression again? And you make a lot of measured decisions about what's worth it and what isn't worth it. There's no question that physical pain can trigger a recurrence of depression in someone who is subject to depression. What was shocking to me was that the people in the emergency room that I went to, which was supposedly the best emergency room in the city where I live, didn't have any understanding of what the psychiatric ramifications could be of the relative carelessness with which they treated this physical pain, even though I tried to tell them. And they all said, you're not a doctor. I'm a doctor. I know what we're doing. And in fact, I did have a severe relapse into depression following that dislocated shoulder episode, and it took some time for me to emerge from it. And I was on medications, which I started at that point for almost 2 years.
This is personal with you. This isn't just Andrew Solomon, the reporter. Does that personal affinity with this deeply personal experience make you a better reporter, or does it in some ways mitigate against you being able to be objective about it?
My ambition in writing this book was to do a number of things, but two of them were to describe as accurately and as clearly as I could my own experience, and to talk objectively and lucidly about the findings of modern science and the experiences of other people. I think having had my own experience gave me an authority and made me informed about the subject in a way that nothing else could. You know, there's an old maxim that the wounded doctor heals best, and I don't think that I could have had the kind of passion about this subject that I had if I hadn't known it myself.
It is an astonishing gift that you have given us to tell us this story in the detail that you do in The Noonday Demon. We're going to be back in just a moment with Andrew Solomon. Please be with us.